We extend our thanks to Brother Clint for taking a difficult and at times emotional topic and for giving a good biblical explanation of his position. Before we open for questions, I just want to give a little warning that this is one of those subjects where people can become upset. And if you want to ask a question, I want you to think very carefully about the wording of your question. This is a Bible study, and we want to consider what the scriptures say about this subject. So think about your question, and if you'd like to ask it, just raise your hand, and Brother Logan here will bring you the microphone. We'll go first to Billy Dickinson, and then to Randy Tidmore.
Great job, Clint. We know the first question, or the main question people will ask, and it's an emotional question. What would you do? What would you do if someone attacked you? What would you do if someone attacked your wife or your children? And the way I like to answer that is, I think most people in the church agree that if someone attacks you because you're a Christian, in other words, it's persecution, that even those who believe that they could respond with violence if it's, you know, they're just simply attacked, in kind of the ordinary realm, we might say, they would admit that if you're attacked because you're a Christian, you do nothing, that you have to suffer persecution. And so I like to put the question back to them. What would you do? What would we do if some people came into this building, and we know it's happening here and there, and they attacked us because we are Christians? What would we do? Well, the truth is, we don't really know what we would do. Not really when you get down to it, but we know what we should do. And we know what Jesus did. We know what the early church did. And so really, when you get down to it, they're in the same boat that we are. What would they do? Put that question back to them. Do you think that's a good way to respond to that?
I do, in the sense that what kind of moral and ethical reasoning are we using when we put someone in a moment of temptation and we hope that they are weak enough to compromise the scripture? And if they are, then that means we should be too. What would you do if you were away from your wife and a woman propositioned you? You found her very beautiful. You knew your wife never would know. What would you do? You can say what the Bible says. Do you know what you would do? What would you do if you were in a situation where someone was offering you drugs or alcohol? You were the only person around who wasn't participating in it. People were laughing at you and humiliating you and deriding you. What would you do? Would you say no, really? Wouldn't you go ahead and drink? Wouldn't you go ahead and do drugs? So how does that make you feel? Is that good logic? Is that a way we study the Bible? By causing us to focus on our weaknesses and frailties as humans so that we ignore what the Bible plainly says? I want to say something else. If we really believe what Billy said, and that's what I've read in all the arguments in favor of self-defense, people say, now, we're saying you can defend yourself against a mugger or some thief on the street. We're not saying Stephen could have killed the Jews if he didn't want to die. If that's the case, why do you bring a gun to church?
Amen.
Why are they coming into the church to kill Christians in the church? If that's not religious persecution, what is? And if you justify that it is permissible for a Christian to bring a loaded firearm to the church building to kill anyone who wants to come in and attack us as God's people in our time of worship, then you have completely undermined the martyrdom of the ancient saints. They weren't faithful, they were just stupid. Is that what you believe? Unacceptable.
Randy Tidmore, Jerry Dickinson, Lauren Garr.
I guess I gotta keep my emotions in check, don't I?
It's very, very good. A couple of things I want to try to as quickly as I can, you know. Back in my young years, the draft was still going. These were not issues. We had to be conscientious objectors. And one of the questions that they asked us, the draft boards would ask us, what would you do And brethren taught us to say, I don't know what I would do, but I know what I ought to do. When I was in the fourth grade, I heard Brother Edwin Morris in a meeting in the Fort Worth area preach. And in that preaching, he says when he's away from his family, he wants them to be safe. But he made the statement, I'd rather have God protecting them than the Marines. And I think we lose sight of that idea sometimes, you know. And I don't want to try to say, I don't want to sound like I think I'm holier than anybody. But I've tried to look at this really from a spiritual view. And it would be better for me to die in a saved condition and that person still have a chance to hear the gospel before he dies than for me to send him his soul to hell at that moment.
I agree with that. That's one of the reasons I don't believe we can go to war. I think the same principle applies. And I put this chart up here on the board so that when people are forming their hypotheticals, just glance over here occasionally and be reminded of all the things the Bible says we can do. You know, Jesus used several little proverbs about, what was the thing he said? If this is how you're reacting when the tree's green, what are you going to do when it's dry? Right now, the tree is green. You know, we're safe. This is the time for us to think and reason and to prepare ourselves. And anyone who tries to imply that I don't keep my family safe just because I don't have a weapon on hand to kill an intruder, I can contend against that. That's not so. My family and I, we can make plans how to get out of the house if something is happening. Our church can make plans. How can the women and children get out? And maybe other people can stand up and be the sacrifice if that's what you had to do. I secure my premises. I mean, don't you have locks on your doors? I do. And if I felt that I needed it, I might get an alarm system. There's other ways to secure your premises. I've called the police before. One time I thought somebody was breaking into my apartment. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was sick, had food poisoning. I wasn't married yet. The first thing I thought to do, I got out my phone and I had old sister Pearl Wilson's number right up. Of course, she was 93. She might have been awake, but I don't know if she could have done anything. I thought about calling Ronnie Wade. Don't know if he could have done anything either. Mother lived all the way in Tulsa. Oh, I could call the police, couldn't I? And I did after a while, after I'd eliminated Pearl and some of the others. And, you know, somebody's beating on the door. I won't get into the whole story. It turned out to be a false alarm, but it was a frightening situation. But I am happy to tell you, I'm not boasting, I'm happy to tell you that I sat down in my living room and I prayed that God would keep me safe. And I did everything that I felt like reasonably I could do. I didn't have a pepper spray or a taser or something like that, something non-lethal. But you know, you could invest in that. I believe you could. I believe if they could tie up the Gergesene demoniac, you could pepper spray a mugger in the face or a rapist or something like that and put him down. You're not going to kill him. Pepper spray hurts. It doesn't kill. It doesn't even reasonably maim a person for the rest of their life. You get away from him. That's what that's for. A loud whistle, a big loud horn, something to call attention of other people that are around you to come and help you. All of these are reasonable scriptural responses. So just throw that out there again while you're formulating your hypotheticals.
We have a lot of questioners lined up. So Jerry Dickinson, Lauren Garl, Noah Howard.
Well, similar to what Randy said, when I was 19 years old, I went before the draft board. The Vietnam War was going on, and I had to go before the draft board, and they asked me, young man, you're a conscientious objector, what would you do if somebody broke in your house and attacked you or your family? And my answer was, instead of I don't know, I said, you know, I might take a baseball bat and kill the man. I'm not sure. But that wouldn't make it right. That'd be wrong. I know what the Bible says. But you know what? I want to go back and reference to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, when the king said, I'm going to throw you in the fiery furnace, what are you going to do? They said, we're not careful. The King James says, we're not careful to answer this matter. I believe other translations say, we don't have to answer that question. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says God is faithful. He won't tempt us above what we're able to bear, and he'll provide a way of escape. Now, God's faithful, and either we trust him or we don't. And so when people ask us, what are you going to do? I don't have to answer that. I trust God. God said he will take care of me. He'll provide a way of escape. Either I believe that or I don't, and I don't have to answer. We don't have to answer that question. We don't have to answer all these hypotheticals. And maybe we shouldn't. We ought to just say what they did. God will take care of me. Even if I die, I believe in God, and God will take care of me.
That's true.
Lauren Garrow.
Clint, I'm grateful you took on this topic. It's a difficult topic. And you've taken the traditional pacifist viewpoint. But I think it needs to be pointed out some of the alternative views to that, especially where you get to, you know, in Exodus 22:2, you mentioned that it was only because of surprise that bloodshed wouldn't be imputed. The other alternative view is that at night, the person would not be able to tell if the intruder was trying to harm them or not. So they could make the assumption that the intruder was there to take their life. In the daytime, you know, this started off before with the stealing of the sheep and so forth. In the daytime, if they could determine that it was theft, then they should allow the governing authorities to take care of that. So then we go on over to another verse that you cited. So if you accept that it was because they could identify that it was theft and not intentional harm. Going back to Luke 22, so let's read 22:35-38. And he said to them, when I sent you without money bag, knapsack, and sandals, did you lack anything? So they said, nothing. Then he said to them, but now he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack. And he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you, that which is written must still be accomplished in me. And he was numbered with the transgressors for the things concerning me and have an end. So he said to them, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. So this happens right after the initiation of the Lord's Supper, before Jesus goes out to the garden. It's his final time with the apostles, or disciples at this time. And it harkens back to the sending, the limited commission, and the sending of the 70, and the sending out of the apostles. There he said to them, take nothing for the journey, neither staffs, nor bag, nor bread, nor money, and do not have two tunics apiece. That was Luke 9:3. And then in 10:3-4, he says, go your way. Behold, I send you out as lambs among wolves. Carry neither money bag, nor knapsack, nor sandals, and greet no one along the road. So at this time, he's telling them to provide for themselves. Knapsack, money, and swords. So, I mean, we don't disagree with the knapsack or the money. Why should we disagree with the swords? Also, I mean, it seems, as you pointed out, and you denied it is so, but it looks like the principle is being brought over that you see in 1 Timothy 5:8, that a man needs to provide for his family. So in this instance, we know that there was at least two swords. We don't know that they didn't go out and buy more later on. You know, this seems like a commandment for the people after this to provide for themselves, and that here, a sword, an instrument of deadly force, was permissible. He's bringing forth what you see in Exodus 22 into the New Testament for this limited, for a person who was attacked. You know, they were going to go out on the road or for their families. And this, we have concrete examples that they had these weapons, that they did carry them when they were with Jesus. And later on, when Peter takes off the Arimathaeus, Jesus does not tell him to get rid of his sword. He tells him to sheathe it. You know, he's going to keep it for later use. So here we have these concrete examples that they defended themselves, that they provided for that, in contrast to what you have in Matthew 5, at the Sermon on the Mount, where it says, you know, turn the other cheek. This seems to be more of a look at vengeance, because it harkens back to the Deuteronomy, you know, where the vengeance was limited to what was done. You know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You couldn't go beyond those levels. You know, if a person took out your eye, you couldn't kill their family and so forth. So this harkens back to that vengeance. And those words are also very hyperbolic. Earlier on in that section. All right. I understand. So in those questions, it talks about if a man looks at a woman with lust in his eyes, you know, that is adultery, and that the rightful offense is the rightful thing is to pluck out his eyes. So that's clearly hyperbolic. We don't do that. So there's the, you know, pacifist view looks at that as a very concrete example in contrast to what we see what's clearly done. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, let me do as quickly as possible. First, in the Exodus 22 passage, if the point is you don't know if he has a weapon, if he has a weapon, it's okay to kill him. You don't know if he has a weapon because it's dark. Then it should say, if the sun has risen on him and you see he has a weapon, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. You see, there's no mention there. There's no mention of a weapon in the passage. So that's reading a supposition of the passage. That's the reason one of the reasons I reject that. Even though, you know, this didn't hang the whole issue, because this is an old covenant principle. And I don't see anything like this in the New Covenant, unless, of course, it's the points that you drew. In Luke 22, when they say, Lord, look, here are two swords, and he says, it is enough. The reason I don't think about knapsacks the way I think about swords is because it doesn't say about knapsacks what it says about swords. Says two swords is enough. Now, when Peter drew his sword, this is what I want to say to you. When Peter drew his sword and cut off Malchus's ear, Jesus did not say, Peter, put your sword back in your sheath. You'll use that later. You can use that to defend yourself. You don't need to use it to defend me. He said, put away your sword, for whoever takes the sword will perish by the sword. Now that statement seems to me to be in keeping with what the prophets saw about the nature of Messiah's rule in the lives of men. They would beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And we don't read about any apostle in the book of Acts carrying around a sword and fighting off a thief or a criminal on the roadside. We don't see any examples like that in the history of the apostles. And so I know we're limited on time. That's as much as I can say, brother. But my contention would be that there is no mention of a weapon in the Exodus 22 passage. And Peter, who drew the sword, not long after Jesus said, two swords is enough, I think when Peter heard the words, put away your sword, for whoever takes the sword will perish by the sword, I don't think he would have understood, oh, okay, I'll kill someone later when they're after me. I think he would have understood that this means he's not to use that sword any longer as a disciple of Jesus. That's my understanding, and I'm trying to be brief, extra brief, because I know there's other questions.
We have time to come back to you, brother. Let's go to Aubrey Smith, Lance Nilsson, Alan Bonifay.
Excellent presentation. Enjoyed that. You mentioned briefly Lamech's poem in Genesis chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. And I just wanted to bring something out of that context, see if you had any comments on it. Genesis chapter 4, you've got the lineage of Cain, the genealogy following Cain, and Lamech, his story is included in that. And the Bible kind of pauses at Lamech, makes special note of him, and brings out the quote. The lineage of Cain, you have a lot of focus on worldly accomplishments, worldly things, worldly deeds. It doesn't say anything about their service to God. Then in chapter 5, you move into Seth's lineage, and the focus is entirely on service to God. Everyone who is brought out specifically is talked about as serving God, calling on his name, walking with God. Enoch is called out specifically. Now, it's interesting that Lamech is the seventh from Enoch, or seventh from Adam, seventh generation. Enoch is also the seventh from Adam. They're part of the same generation, and I think they're representative of their families as a whole and their attitudes of their families. So we have Lamech. He has this quote. He says that, "I've killed a man for wounding me. I've acted as judge, jury, and executioner in this case." We also have a quote from Enoch in the book of Jude, and I just think it's noteworthy. It's interesting that what the only recorded words of Jude also have to do with judgment. And he says, "Behold, the Lord is coming to execute judgment upon all that are ungodly." I think that illustrates the principle that judgment belongs to God. We have no right to execute judgment. Whether we think that someone is wronging us and we have that right in that example or not, judgment belongs to God. We need to look toward the judgment to come.
Good job. Appreciate that.
Lance Nielsen, Alan Bonifay, Roger Bennett.
Clint, been looking forward to this for about 2 years, so I really appreciate you taking this on. Yeah, I know it wasn't easy for you, so I think you did a really good job. I had a couple quick things here. One thing I just wanted to add to what you said, as far as where Christians belong and where they don't belong, one thing I've always heard is nothing good after midnight, you know, happens. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, especially biblical principles when it comes to where we belong, especially as you kind of get into the college years for a lot of the young Christians. A lot of things happen at night, especially when you get to college. And, you know, you put yourself in bad situations sometimes. And, you know, 1 Thessalonians 5:7, those that sleep, sleep at night. Those who drink, get drunk at night, and things like that. So sometimes we can avoid a lot of these situations staying out of places where we don't belong. So that's one of my first points. Second thing I had was, as far as one thing you had on there, what we can do as far as restraining somebody. They're typically not going to just lay down and give you their gun. And so I took self-defense classes for many years. I want to just ask your opinion on that, as far as Christians in taking self-defense classes, not necessarily killing somebody, but physical violence. Sometimes that might include breaking someone's arm or, you know, hurting somebody seriously. Do you think there's any place for Christians in self-defense classes?
That's a good question. I'm inclined to think that that's not the right approach to take in preparing for these things. As far as preparing yourself to break someone's arm or break someone's leg as the way of restraining them, that might happen accidentally, but if that's your goal is to maim them or injure them in some extreme way, my immediate response is that there's probably another way. I was reading a book where a fellow was arguing in favor of these options for the attacked Christian. And he talked about, you know, a man that's working as an orderly in a mental institution, and some deranged person goes wild and he's running around and harming people. Nobody, I think, would justify gunning him down. I think people would say, you know, for he needs to be restrained. And maybe that means he's tackled, and maybe in the process of being tackled, he's severely injured. In fact, it's possible he could even die. But the goal is not to kill him. The goal is to restrain him in some way to keep him from committing a crime. So I'm not going to come out really firm against self-defense classes as you're discussing them. I just have to think about it. I'm not sure about that. Maybe someone else can give another word on that. You know, in the Numbers passage, The statement was always, if you do something to him by which he could die, something that is reasonably expected to cause death, and that included taking up a weapon or an implement that is a lethal weapon or something that the way you're going to use it, it's reasonable to think that he might die. If you know how to restrain the man, hold him, pin him down, keep him from doing any more harm in a way that you know that he's not going to die, he's just going to be incapacitated till the authorities can come, then it would be difficult for me to say that that is unscriptural.
Alan, Roger Boone, Greg Gay.
I thought that was excellent, Clint, and I agreed with you. I think about these swords, that all we can say about the purpose of these swords is what Luke said, first of all, that he would be numbered with the transgressors. And number two, what was done with the swords and what Jesus' response was. Now, that's all we can be sure of. I believe that Jesus was teaching a graphic lesson, don't take up the sword, period. All who take it will perish by it. That's what the lesson was that he taught with the swords. That's all you can draw from that. This question about what would you do that the draft board might ask you, I would just like to say in agreement with, but in addition to what Randy and Jerry said, we may have a draft board again sometime, and whatever you would do is not parallel to going to war, first of all. That's the first thing. Whatever you do, if someone broke in your home, it's not parallel to going to war. It's a dishonest, unfair question. And then, of course, as Randy said, and Jerry too, we know what's right, and that's what we should do. Billy mentioned, what would we do if somebody broke into a church? Well, 40 years ago, somebody broke into the St. Albans Church, and I'll tell you what they did. A sister got up and said, these kids don't need to be in here, I'm taking them out. And she did. The guy was standing there with a automatic M1. Or M16. And then, after things settled down, one of the brethren, the brother who was up there teaching, said, sir, can we go ahead with our services? And that's what they did until the police got there and someone just dialed down the situation. No one was hurt, fortunately. But that's what they did. And that's the sort of behavior that we should have if we're in this kind of situation. And then, at the risk of turning this all upside down and upsetting everybody, I have nothing against hunters. I have nothing against hunting. I like to eat what hunters kill. I don't like to hunt myself, but I enjoy very much eating what Howard Cole hunts, and so on. But I just would like to observe in this day of conservative talk radio, the Constitution of the United States, which I love and I know quite a bit about and have read a lot about, is not inspired and it's not the Bible. And there are some mistakes in it, slavery being one of them. I think that needs to be kept in mind. The right to carry a weapon has nothing to do, I mean, it's there in the Constitution, the Supreme Court says, but it has nothing to do with the Bible or what we should do.
I appreciate you saying those things. I forgot to mention something that Lauren had said, and that was unintentional, about the hyperbole in the Sermon on the Mount. But I do want to say something about that real quick before we go on. I do acknowledge that there's a great deal of hyperbole in the Sermon on the Mount. But just as we should avoid taking it literal and ripping our eye out and cutting our hand off, we should avoid not taking it at all. And the way that some people interpret biblical hyperbole is to strip it away of any real meaning. I think when the Bible uses hyperbole, the idea is that it is teaching something very extreme. The extreme lesson about ripping out the eye and cutting off the hand is that there is nothing on earth worth going to hell over. That's true. Nothing. Nothing on earth That's an extreme statement, but it's true, and Jesus well illustrated it. And I think that the lesson of the hyperbole in, you know, if the man sues you for one thing, give him a few extra things as well, is there are worse things than being defrauded and suffering injustice. See, the old Israelites, they had a guarantee of justice. It was in the law of Moses. They could expect it, they could demand it, they would receive it. Americans have a guarantee of justice, don't we? That's what we think, anyway, because of our Constitution. We have a guarantee of the right to protect ourselves, the right to ensure that our personal property, one of the most significant privileges of American citizens, is guarded against those who would take it away from us, and our safety. But the Lord Jesus teaches us that there are times when we must recognize it is better to sacrifice those rights and to be defrauded and to suffer harm, even to be killed, than to hold on to them. And I'll say this real quick before we go on. You know, Shahe had to deal with a bunch of examples in the Bible of people lying or apparently lying, and we ask, well, is that okay or not? Why hasn't anyone quoted an example of the apostles killing someone in self-defense? And then say, now, Clint, how do you account for that? That's very meaningful. That's one of the major reasons why I hold the position that I do.
Roger Boone, Greg Gay, then we'll see where we are on time.
Oh, I feel like after services, the Q&A will continue.
Thank you, Clint. I appreciate it very much. I just wanted to say something that I think about that sword. I think there's two Greek words for the sword. One has to do with a long sword, a saber, or that kind of sword. But this one, I believe, refers to a short sword. And you know, when anyone goes out on a journey, if you're roughing it, you always take some cutting instrument. Cutting instruments have all kinds of reasons and purposes. Digging a hole, cutting firewood, chopping up food. There's all kinds of reasons for a short sword, especially. It's a versatile tool. That's one thing. The other thing I wanted to say was, I think you had a Matthew 5 verse up there very quickly, but I don't remember us talking anything much about Matthew 5:44 and the scripture to love your enemies.
I can get into that. I did the previous. Yes, I think that's right. I think that... I don't know that when Jesus said what he did here or in Matthew 5:44 on through the rest of the chapter, I'm not inclined to think that he had self-defense in mind, that was what he was particularly discussing. I think he was striking at an underlying difference between the Israelite economy and the Christian system. The Israelite economy was national. It was a system that had provisions made for justice, for the exercise of justice. And the Christian system does not have those guarantees on earth. We trust that God will do justice in the future. But the Christian system is one where things are unnatural, really, in our conduct. We choose a strange way. Dr. Hodge, you remember, he defended self-defense by saying it's instinctual. That it's just, it's what our nature tells us to do. But Jesus, at the end of Matthew 5, tells us to go against our nature, which wouldn't have us love our enemies.
Greg Gay, and then we're going to try to fit in Wes Bonifay, and we'll see.
Thank you, Clint. Very thought-provoking. So, Paul had perils, false brethren, one of them. But those perils were all classed pretty equally. Wasn't he also in perils among robbers? Do I remember that right? And so he did face criminals, obviously successfully. Now, when he was stoned, likely to death, miraculously he came back because the brethren thought him dead, and he got up and walked out of town the next day. So we don't know about those exchanges. But I guess one way to look at it is that perils among false brethren is compared to perils among robbers. And so it's kind of tough when you're the Apostle Paul. What an amazing life he lived. So the police, if you would go back to your things we can do. Now, many of us have had some rather unfortunate exchanges with the police. I remember one night coming home from a play whenever I got to prove that I was sober because of my driving, and Cassie was so entertained by that. But with things like that set aside, the New Testament is very emphatic that the purpose, for the most part, of every police system in every nation is for the protection of God's people. Now, if we do something that government considers wrong, even if it's being a Christian, we're going to be punished for that in that government. But in our land, where we have the freedom to assemble, where we have the freedom of religion, the police, for the most part, are here for our protection. And we need to be thrilled at that blessing, because here are people who are doing things that we cannot and must not do. And they're at our beck and call. And we might have to think of three other people before we figure out who to call them. But nevertheless, I do know that there are people who call others and say, call 911 for me. I just can't do it. So they're there for us. And we need to know that that's part of God's blessing for us. It's just as much a blessing as the medical community is among us. And so let's not be afraid of them when we do what's right, Paul tells us. Let's be thankful for them and use them. And the military operation is the same way. Let's be thankful for the freedoms that we have. Because again, these are worldly individuals doing what Christians cannot and must not do. Now, a long time ago, in another house next door, the neighbor had a dog named Sport. Sport was a Rottweiler. Sport's favorite trick was when I went in the backyard or my children went in the backyard, was to lunge against the fence. And I asked my neighbor, do you think if Sport got through the fence that he would hurt me or my kids? And he said, yeah, he probably would. So would you discuss Christians having dogs that are trained to kill?
You know, that's a good question. I remember one time, I think Carl Johnson was the one who said, I'm a conscientious objector, but my dog isn't. But now the truth is, really. Remember, we've got to be serious about this question, because it is a matter of obedience to God. If murder is the unauthorized, intentional taking of a human life, and I keep a dog around to intentionally take a human life, the dog's not the sinner, but I think I would be. I believe I would be, just as if I kept a .357 to do the same thing the dog would do.
West Bond.
Yeah.
I wanted to respond to your response to Lance about self-defense classes. And you said you would advise restraint that's not going to injure or maim someone. I just wanted to give a personal sort of story. I worked in Oakland, California, in a school for teenagers who had severe emotional disturbance. And these were violent kids, many of them. And I had 2 weeks of training before that job, and we had a list that basically looked exactly like this. It didn't say trust in Providence. But if we were alone, we were to escape, we were to lock the doors, we were to call the police, exactly in that order. If we were with others, we were to restrain. And we spent 80% of those 2 weeks practicing restraints. And this was in California. By California law, you can't leave marks on a child. And we learned restraints where two, three or four adults could restrain a violent kid. Now, we had a child, and I use child in quotes. This was a 15, 16-year-old girl who was almost as tall as I was and maybe three times as broad. And she ran in the common area of the school with a box cutter. And we restrained her, and she was safe, and we were safe, and no one was injured, and no one violated their conscience. And it was physical, but it wasn't to cause injury. And so it is possible, and you don't need weapons, but you need a plan, and you need decisions, and in some cases, you need other people. And if you're by yourself, then maybe your response to an attacker is different than when you're in a group.
Thank you very much.
Very quickly, Bart Shaw, and that is definitely sorry for those who want to follow up.
I just want to give a little bit of it's a variant interpretation of Luke 22, just for food for thought. The only other place, fourth variant. The only other place that says number with the transgressors, it's from Isaiah 53, but it's Mark 15, 28 is the location. And that verse is contested. In fact, in the ESV, it's dropped. And Metzger, I looked up Metzger before tonight, and Metzger says it's not supported. So we don't have support for numbered with transgressors being the criminals on the cross. In other words, is it possible that what Jesus is talking about here are the disciples themselves?
That was my position. I probably wasn't clear enough, but that was my position, that Peter's action was criminal. That was an act of insurrection against Rome. He took up a sword to prevent an arrest.
And so the answer to why two swords is enough, you needed two witnesses in the Old Testament to show that somebody was a transgressor. Because the Isaiah 53 prophecy that says that he will be numbered with the transgressors says that he will commit no violence. And they knew that. They knew Isaiah 53. And so here are these guys with swords, and they're ready to draw the swords and kill people. And Jesus is saying, you're the transgressors. It's not the thieves on the cross, which is the variant version. But instead, it's the disciples themselves. So he's predicting that they're going to transgress in this passage. And so I think it casts it in the light of, it's not saying get swords to take. In other words, you're turning your back on what I've already told you, and you're committing a transgression.
Well, that's very interesting. Very interesting. It is true that when Jesus sees the people, he says, you're coming out to me with spears and swords as one comes against a robber. And his point is, that's ridiculous, because look at me, I'm not a robber. I don't even have a weapon. And in case you doubt that Jesus was harmless and that this arrest was treating a righteous man like a sinner, the Apostle Peter shows what a violent man would look like. I really think, do you think he aimed for the ear? I don't think so. I think he was aiming to cleave his head right in two. He would have killed the man. Again, Jesus' statement was not, this is not what I meant, Peter. Later, you can kill people to protect yourself. I've got to go die on the cross. Don't kill people to protect me. His statement was, whoever takes the sword shall perish by the sword. Violence begets violence, whether through the exercise of justice or through the increase of criminality. And God has a better way. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good.
Anything else?
Oh, no, I better quit while I'm ahead.